Since DNA evidence emerged into the public consciousness in the 1990s, more than 360 people convicted of crimes have been exonerated by DNA evidence, according to the Innocence Project. The number of innocent people who were executed or died in prison will never be known. Welcome to the Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I look at a clinical result and try to see the human story behind the data. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science is developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. Think of this as your official invitation to come over the dark side. Don't worry, we have cookies. And we also have a shared love of hard science, lab techniques, and deep psychological breakdowns. I know I'm not the only one out here who stays up way too late, fascinated by the science of murder. So let's find each other. Pull up to the bench, look at the data, and learn together. Today we are discussing the use of science in overturning convictions and otherwise championing the innocence of people who have been wrongly convicted by a jury of their peers. It starts with an investigation, a trial, a jury, a verdict, a sentence. To the outside world, that sequence is a smooth, inevitable progression. It starts with the flashing blue lights at a cordoned-off crime scene, moves through the sterile, wood-paneled quiet of a courtroom, passes through the collective minds of 12 ordinary citizens, and culminates in the heavy, definitive slam of a cell door. The gavel hits the block, the state archives the case file, and the public moves on, completely confident that the conveyor belt of justice has functioned precisely as intended. We like to look at that sentence as the definitive cinematic end of the story. A neat closing of the ledger where the good guys won and the data was accurately processed. But what happens when the machine processes a false positive? That sentence isn't the end of the story, it's the beginning of a terrifying structural gridlock. The moment a verdict is stamped final, the entire legal architecture undergoes a massive systemic shift. It completely ceases to be an open investigation into objective truth. Instead, it transforms into a defensive fortress designed to protect its own output at any cost. The burden of proof is completely flipped. The presumption of innocence is erased, and the system relies on the legal doctrine of finality to justify looking away from the dashboard, even when the flashing red warning lights of error are screaming for attention. In this episode of The Science of Murder, we're going to perform a thorough quality control audit on this exact post-conviction machinery. We will dismantle the mainstream myth that exoneration is a simple matter of uncovering a pristine strand of DNA and watching prison doors slide open. Instead, we're going to look at the raw friction of the appellate pipeline. We will examine what happens when molecular biology isn't available to save the day, how the courts actively resist correcting their own contaminated data inputs, and the terrifying mathematical reality of running an irreversible execution pipeline with a known human error rate. We're stepping past the cinematic theater of the courtroom to look at the unvarnished reality of institutional power versus objective truth. Because when an uncalibrated machine goes wrong, that final sentence isn't justice. It's just the moment the trap snaps shut on the innocent. There's an unexpected razor-sharp cultural mirror for this exact system failure, and it sits right in the middle of a Broadway stage. Now, look, I know we all watch true crime documentaries in secret, and if you're anything like me, you probably spent a late night analyzing a trial, completely convinced you uncovered a massive hidden conspiracy from your couch. We love the theater of it. And that is exactly why the musical Chicago and the iconic Cell Block Tango work so well. We listen to the rhythmic chorus of He Had It Coming, completely mesmerized by the theatrical gravity of Velma Kelly and Roxy Hart. We watch these women systematically construct their justifications, manipulate the media, and weaponize their defense strategies to play a deeply flawed, entertainment-driven legal process like a fiddle. We laugh at the high-stakes drama. We lean into the spectacle. But while we're distracted by the flash, the jazz hands, and the performance, nobody's paying attention to Catalin Helinski, the one truly innocent woman on that cell block. She is an immigrant with zero resources, completely disconnected from the acceptable language of the court, entirely unable to play the media game. She stands alone, clutching a little white scarf, begging for help with a single unvarnished truth. Not guilty. It is a pitch black satire of our actual justice system. The architecture is so easily distracted by performance, showmanship, and cultural narrative that the quiet, objective data point, the innocent person without a voice, is executed while the audience applauds the theater. We watch the drama, we obsess over the details of the conspiracy, but we don't really pay attention to that little white scarf begging for help. To understand the scale of the system's breakdown, we have to look at the exact entity that forced this quality control audit onto the American legal system in the first place, the Innocence Project. The year is 1992. Attorneys Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld are working as public defenders in New York. They aren't looking at the law through a purely philosophical lens. They are dealing with the daily reality of a broken assembly line. They watch molecular biology begin to make its first crude ripples in the scientific community. They look at restriction fragment length polymorphism, or RFLP, on the emerging potential of polymerase chain reaction, PCR. In laboratory terms, this was a monumental paradigm shift. It meant moving away from legacy testing that required a massive, pristine pool of fresh blood and moving toward an assay that could take a microscopic, degraded biological sample from decades ago, amplify it, and copy it until it created an unbending genetic profile. Shack and Neufeld realize a profound, terrifying truth. If this new scientific assay can prove guilt with absolute statistical certainty going forward, it must also be capable of proving innocence looking backward. They launched the Innocence Project as a small pro bono legal clinic at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York. The original design isn't a massive corporate entity. It's a room full of law students, volunteers, and boxes of archived dusty transcripts, trying to answer a simple baseline question. If we track down the biological evidence from decades-old convictions and run this new assay, what will the data tell us? The mainstream legal architecture expected the project to find a few anomalies, those unfortunate one-in-a-million flukes in an otherwise stellar system. Instead, the data output blew the doors clean off the courthouse. When the Innocence Project started running these DNA assays, they didn't just free individuals, they exposed deep systemic rot. The hard data from their very first wave of exonerations revealed that the absolute gold standard bulletproof tools that juries have been relying on for every single day were actually completely contaminated data inputs. First, look at the sheer fallibility of eyewitnesses. The raw metrics showed that over 70% of these DNA-proven wrongful convictions were built entirely on the backs of confident, well-intentioned, but utterly mistaken eyewitnesses. The system was treating human memory like an immutable digital archive when the science proves it's actually highly malleable, easily manipulated, and completely corrupted by time. But it doesn't stop with bad memory. The data also exposed the absolute fiction of what I call junk science. Forensics that had been treated as absolute gospel in the courtroom for over a century. Things like bite mark analysis, hair microscopy, and shoe print geometry were suddenly unmasked as nothing more than subjective guesswork masquerading as objective biology. There were no control groups, no standardized error rates, and zero real science backing them up. And maybe the most disturbing thing the telemetry forced society to confront was the psychological paradox of coercion. The data proved that over a quarter of these DNA-exonerated individuals had actually confessed or pled guilty to horrific crimes they did not commit. They were completely broken down by interrogation tactics designed to extract compliance and closure rather than the objective truth. Fast forward to today, and the Innocence Project has evolved far beyond a tiny pro bono law clinic in New York. It has transformed into a massive global civil rights movement. If you look at the raw exoneration metrics right now, DNA testing has contributed to over 600 total exonerations across the United States, with more than 200 of those individuals directly represented by the Innocence Project itself. We're talking about dozens of human beings who were walking mere steps away from the execution chamber on death row. That single clinic birthed the Global Innocence Network, which is a massive coalition of independent legal and investigative clinics stretching across every single state and into multiple countries, handling both DNA cases and the brutal non-DNA constitutional challenges we are diving into tonight. And the organization isn't just playing defense on the bench anymore. They have shifted their immense analytical weight directly into legislative policy. They are actively rewriting the rules of the assay by forcing states to mandate the recording of all interrogations, completely overhaul police lineup mechanics, expand post-conviction DNA access laws, and ban unreliable, unscientific forensic techniques from ever entering a courtroom again. They started out as a couple of public defenders running a localized quality control test on old dusty files. They ended up building an independent structural oversight committee that proved the entire diagnostic machine of American justice was running dangerously hot with a catastrophic error rate. But do not let those massive systemic wins fool you into thinking the fight is simple or that the system welcomes the correction. Because mainstream success breeds a very specific, comfortable myth. If you grew up watching TV in the 1980s, there's a narrative blueprint that plays in your head when you think about justice. You can practically hear the voiceover. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, you picture the A-team rolling up in a black and gray GMC van, completely bypassing the red tape, breaking all the rules, and using brute force and rogue ingenuity to save the day in exactly 45 minutes plus commercials. It's a comforting cinematic fantasy. And subconsciously, that is exactly how the mainstream public visualizes the Innocence Project. We treat them like a legal A-team. We imagine this elite squad of rogue, brilliant lawyers and hyper-focused investigators who can be summoned to swoop into a maximum security prison, bypass the bureaucratic gridlock, smash through the corrupt state machinery, and magically deliver justice on a silver platter. But here is the grim, unvarnished reality. Hannibal Smith isn't coming. There is no armored van. The Innocence Project doesn't operate in a physical world of rogue vigilante justice. They have to work within the confines of that exact same broken, slow-moving, defensive diagnostic machine that wrongfully convicted their clients in the first place. For every single file they take on, there are thousands of letters begging for help that they simply do not have the resources to answer. Finding them is only the first impossible hurdle. Once you find them, the real battle isn't a fast-paced, action-packed montage. It's a brutal, exhausting, decades-long siege against an institutional architecture that would rather keep an innocent person in a cage than admit its original data entry was flawed. And that brings us to the core illusion of this entire setup. We have been thoroughly conditioned by mainstream media and television procedurals to view the Innocence Project through a very narrow, high-tech lens. The public loves to imagine this clean cinematic resolution where molecular biology just swoops in to save the day at the 11th hour. But the mainstream perception that an investigator can just walk into a dusty evidence locker, find a pristine swab of DNA, run it through a machine, and watch the prison doors slide open is an absolute myth. As an analytical reality, molecular biology is a high-end luxury. It's a luxury that simply isn't available in the massive percentage of wrongful convictions. In thousands of archived case files, there's no pristine blood stain, there's no intact hair sample with the root attached, and there is no biological fluid left behind to run through the sequencer. Think about it this way. When you lose that biological trump card, you lose the clean, binary certainty of science. You're forced to leave the laboratory entirely and fight a brutal uphill battle through the raw friction of constitutional challenges. Suddenly, you aren't standing in front of a judge arguing about base pairs, alleles, and statistical probabilities. Instead, you're dealing with ugly structural errors. Things like egregious Brady violations, where prosecutors intentionally hid exculpatory evidence, or severe catastrophic breakdowns in the basic right to competent counsel. Without DNA, you're essentially trying to dismantle a reinforced concrete wall using nothing but a tiny crowbar of procedural law. We see this systemic friction clearly when we look at cases like Tony Carruthers, where everything hinges on deep constitutional challenges. You see, the appellate system does not tolerate a vacuum, and it is a profoundly insulated by procedural hurdles and the rigid doctrine of finality. If you stand before an appellate judge and successfully prove that the state's original data inputs were contaminated, the court's institutional response is almost never an immediate correction. More often than not, their response is effectively, "Okay, fine. Maybe the trial wasn't perfect. But if he didn't do it, who did? Give us a name or the conviction stands." It sounds backwards because it is. Juries are told that the burden of proof rests entirely on the state, but the moment the prison door locks, that rule is completely flipped. Courts desperately want you to prove alternative suspects for them. They shift the entire burden of proof back onto the defense, essentially demanding that a small team of nonprofit lawyers solve a brutal homicide decades after the trail went stone cold just to get the system to look at its own constitutional violations. The machine demands that you act as a pristine, independent, cold case investigative agency, forcing you to track down a brand new target just to get the judge to acknowledge that the state's initial data collection tools were fundamentally broken from day one. And this is where we have to stop looking at the law as the abstract philosophical ideal and start looking at it for what it actually is, a diagnostic instrument run by human beings. This brings us directly back to the quality control framework of our legal system. And honestly, it forces us to confront a linguistic trick we play on ourselves every single day. We stand in courtrooms and we talk about this golden standard, beyond a reasonable doubt. We use that phrase like a cultural safety blanket so we can sleep at night after sending people to prison. But if we're being completely honest, what does that phrase actually mean to you? What does it mean to a jury of 12 ordinary people who just want to go home to their families? If you ask a statistician or look at it through a strict analytical lens, beyond a reasonable doubt is not 100% mathematical certainty. It can't be. It is a subjective human calculation of probability. We're asking a group of people to look at fragmented, often contaminated data inputs and make a guess that they feel safe with. But here's the question I want to open us up for us to really think about. When a diagnostic system has a known, documented, non-zero error rate, how can we possibly justify applying an irreversible absolute output like the death penalty or a life sentence without parole? From an engineering standpoint, it's a catastrophic design failure. Think about it in a clinical laboratory setting. If you have an instrument on the bench that has a known 4% failure rate, an instrument that routinely generates uncorrectable false positives that could ruin a patient's life, what do you do? Do you just keep running patient samples anyway and call those errors the necessary cost of doing business? Do you say, well, the machine gets it right 96% of the time, so that's good enough? Of course you don't. You take the machine offline immediately. You pull the instrument off the bench, you run controls, and you recalibrate the system because an uncalibrated machine is an active public safety hazard. So why don't we do that with the legal system? Why does our legal architecture routinely value the absolute illusion of finality over the ongoing pursuit of objective verification? It seems like as a society, we would genuinely rather protect a broken, definitive output than just to keep the assembly line moving, rather than pause, look at the dashboard, and admit that our initial data collection tools were fundamentally flawed. We're terrified of the alternative, because if we admit the machine is uncalibrated, we have to admit that the prison doors aren't holding monsters. They're holding our own systemic mistakes. And that is a conversation a lot of people just aren't brave enough to have. If we're gonna have an honest conversation about this, we have to stop talking about percentages and instruments, and we have to start looking at the names etched into the concrete. I want you to picture a memorial wall, not for soldiers, but a stark, cold registry of the individuals who were caught in the gears of this uncalibrated machine. This isn't an exhaustive archive. It's just a microscopic cross-section of a massive, frozen injustice iceberg. Think about Kirk Bloodsworth. In 1984, the system decided he was a monster. He was convicted of the brutal sexual assault and murder of a 9-year-old girl in Maryland and sentenced to death. The state's data inputs looked ironclad to the jury. 5 separate eyewitnesses stood up, pointed at him, and swore they were confident. But human memory failed. In 1993, the Innocence Project ran a new essay on the archived biological evidence. The DNA telemetry proved he wasn't the guy. He became the first death row inmate in American history to be completely exonerated by DNA. But it cost him 9 years of an innocent life permanently erased. And then you have cases that become a full-blown media spectacle, like the Central Park Five. In 1990, five teenagers were sent away for a horrific assault on a jogger in New York. The system didn't have DNA, but it had confessions. What the public didn't see was the coercive, marathon, unrecorded interrogations that broke these boys down until they said whatever the detectives wanted to hear, just to make the nightmare stop. Juries believed the theater over the data. It took 12 years, until 2002, for a serial rapist to step forward and confess, backed up by perfect, unbending DNA profile match from the archived crime scene data. Those five men gave up a combined 30 years of their youth to protect a false narrative. But it gets even darker when there's no DNA left to test. In 1983, Marvin Anderson was convicted of a brutal sexual assault in Virginia based on mistaken eyewitness identification. The state actually possessed the physical evidence that could clear him, but due to systemic carelessness, the swabs were lost in an unmonitored storage facility for decades. Anderson spent 15 years behind bars and another 7 on parole, fighting a relentless uphill battle through constitutional challenges without his biological trump card. When a defense attorney finally found the forgotten evidence tucked inside a completely unrelated file folder in 2001, the DNA test didn't just clear Anderson. It identified this actual perpetrator who had gone on to commit dozens of other crimes while Anderson was in a cell. It's the ultimate proof that an uncalibrated machine doesn't just harm the innocent, it completely fails to protect the public. And then we arrive at the absolute failure of quality control, the place where the error becomes completely irreversible. In 1995, Arkansas sentenced Liddell Lee to death for the murder of his neighbor. His trial was a disaster of contaminated data. He had an incompetent defense counsel who failed to introduce his alibi, and the state refused to run forensic testing on the biological material left at the scene. In 2017, the state ran a mass execution schedule, rushing Lee to the execution chamber before the data could be verified. 4 years after his death, the Innocence Project finally won the right to run the DNA assays on the weapon and the shirt left behind. The data proved the DNA belonged to a completely different, unknown male. The state executed the wrong person. When you strip away the music, the showmanship, and the political speeches, this is the cold ledger left behind on the bench. Kirk Bloodsworth, sentenced to death, 1984. Exonerated, 1993. Rolando Cruz, sentenced to death, 1985. Exonerated, 1995. Sabrina Butler, sentenced to death, 1990. Exonerated, 1995. Ray Crone, sentenced to death, 1992. Exonerated, 2002. Derek Jameson, sentenced to death, 1985. Exonerated, 2005. Cameron Todd Willingham, executed, 2004. Evidence of innocence confirmed posthumously, 2009. Liddell Lee, executed, 2017. Exonerated, posthumously, 2021. There are currently roughly 2,000 people sitting on death row across 27 states in the United States as of June 2026. As we celebrate 250 years of a country founded on the values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we have to look at the statistical failure rate of the machine we built. If our systemic error rate holds steady at 4.1%, that means at least 80 of those human beings currently waiting to be processed by the state are mathematically likely to be completely innocent. Do those 80 people just not count against our stated values? Or do we just consider them the acceptable cost of for the greater good? What if your loved one was one of the falsely accused? What if you were the wrongly convicted person sitting on death row? Is this still worth it? The people behind the Innocence Project say it isn't. How about you? As we wrap up today's look into the structural gridlock of post-convection machine, the uphill battle of non-DNA cases, and the exhausting work of the Innocence Project, we're moving forward into the final, heaviest phase of our systemic audit, the death penalty. Next week, we are stepping right up to the absolute edge of the conveyor belt, where systemic error becomes completely irreversible. We will apply strict laboratory quality control metrics to the state's execution pipeline, confront the pitch-black reality of posthumous exonerations, and look at the raw, terrifying mathematics of a machinery that values the illusion of finality over the preservation of innocent human life. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue analyzing these cases along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the mechanics of memory fascinating, please take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred platform. Reviews are the lifeblood of an independent show. They help other science-minded true crime fans find our community. I highly encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to come learn along with us. I always want to hear your analytical breakdowns of these cases or any future topics you want to see dissected on the bench. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon at Science of Murder, or reach out directly via email at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious. Stay scientific, and I'll see you in the next episode.